There's something about fifth symphonies, and especially their opening motives. Take, for example, the beginning of Mahler's fifth symphony. I'm Colleen Phelps, and this is Keeping Score. Right away, Mahler gives us the tiniest of fanfares before the music gives way to total rage. Mahler had his own brush with mortality in the form of illness, but he followed it by meeting the love of his life. And that's the tumult that led to the composition of this piece. It's not a narrative, but it does show a transformation from darkness to light. This symphony is not to be taken lightly. It's a journey, and it needs forces that are capable of pulling the audience along. Maestro Giancarlo Guerrero knows he has those forces, and that's why he says he chose Mahler 5 for this particular season, a behemoth of a piece of music so well-suited to the Nashville Symphony's players, and somehow also to this lively and cheerful maestro. The best word I can use to describe Giancarlo is exuberant. He exudes passion for the music and especially for the situation he works in, making classical music with these players in this town. And he's a morning person for sure. It's a rarity among musicians. So coffee in hand, I met him at 8 a.m. to talk about Mahler's Fifth. I want to read a little quote about Mahler. Mm-hmm. Well, not so profound, though. In 2011, cartoonist John Bogenschütz did a flowchart called Can't Remember Which Mahler Symphony You Just Saw? Well, we can help you out. And the first thing in the flowchart is, did it start with a trumpet solo? Yes, it's the fifth.
Well, there's something about that fanfare, which is very recognizable. And you can also make the connection because it begins with pa-pa-pa-pam, pa-pa-pa-pam. There's another fifth that starts like that. And I think there's a direct reference to the most famous of the fifth, which is Beethoven's. In this case, Mahler turns it into a military fanfare. And that follows with a funeral march, very much in his personality. But you also have to remember that this was not the first time that he was using this fanfare. He used it in the first movement of the fourth symphony, direct quotation. So this is not original music. In the big climax of the first movement of the fourth, this same fanfare comes out, but this time surrounded by the whole orchestra. It's always been a mystery why the composer decided to recycle that very powerful moment in the fourth symphony to open the fifth. But as you say, it is one of the most poignant moments in classical music.
And you're kind of in the season of the fate motive because you already had a Beethoven 5. And I spent a while talking to Christopher Rouse about that for this same podcast. He went to the space of, don't ever think it. Sometimes a composer is evoking something and sometimes it's consciously and sometimes it's unconsciously. But Mahler was a Beethoven fan.
Not only was he a Beethoven fan, he reorchestrated all of the symphonies. But you're absolutely right. Not only did he love him, but he admired him. And even though the beginning has that fateful four notes, ba-ba-ba-bam, that's not the only time. Throughout the first and second movement, you hear that very clearly, that there is a revisiting. And yeah, sometimes you do that on subconsciously. But I think in this case, Mahler was trying to pay some sort of an homage to the great symphonies of the 19th century. And the Fifth Symphony, remember, was the first great symphony of the 20th century. This piece is from 1901. So this is really a bridge in many ways of that symphonic tradition from the 19th century that would lead into the 20th century and open the door for people like Shostakovich, who would, eventually write 15 symphonies of his own.
And the brightness of the trumpet call turns to darkness pretty quickly in the symphony. And the funeral is early in the symphony, and then it turns to light. Do you think that's because Mahler was in love?
Well, Mahler, this was kind of his calling card, the whole idea of giving you, you know, a sense of hope, but then fate and life would come crashing down. And in his case, Mahler, I think, really had a very tragic life, even compared to some other composers and artists that dealt with tragedy. Mahler was an expert at it. I mean, somebody who 8 siblings died in infancy, that tells you that this was a man that was intimately related to death. And even in his own professional life, as successful as he was always marred by conflict and by challenges.
There's such a tragic love story, and it's almost right after he came around to realizing that, I mean, she was a composer, and right after, you know, he asked her to give it up when they got married, and it was right really after he realized that she needed that fulfillment. She needed to compose, and the marriage counselor said she needs to compose, that the heart condition just took him. Mm-hmm.
Well, Alma was a force of nature in many cases. She was not only a composer, she was also a writer, a poet. She was an all-around artist from a very wealthy family. And in most people said that she was probably even the most beautiful woman in Vienna at the time. So the fact that Gustav Mahler ended up with her was a great, you know, sense of pride for him. But because she was so incredibly talented, she was also a very complicated person. And imagine having two temperamental people like Mahler and Alma together. I mean, that must have been one for the ages. I think Romeo and Juliet have nothing, you know, compared to these guys.
He uses the Ländler for reference. I have two moments of the Ländler that I love in popular art, in The Sound of Music, when Maria dances in the garden with Captain Von Trapp, and the Brahms Requiem, Wie lieblich, the How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place, set to a German folk dance.
Well, Mahler utilized, you know, folk music quite extensively in his compositions. I mean, he wrote an entire set of songs from Das Knaben Wunderhorn, the children's magic horn, which is all about Austrian folklore. And it's no surprise that, like other composers, he utilized dances from his own land as well. The Ländler being one of them, but it was a few. I mean, he used scherzos, he used minuets, he used funeral marches. I mean, everything that was available to him, he wrote it. You compare, of course, to Sound of Music. Well, Sound of Music is set in Austria, so you can see where that all comes from. In the case of Mahler, of course, it tends to have a little bit more of a dramatic feel to it. It's not intended to be dance. I think it's intended to bring memories. In his case, a lot of the times these are childhood memories. And many times these childhood memories are not very happy. So even though these songs are intended to be celebratory or be accompanied by alcohol or be done with picnics and celebration, in the case of Mahler, in the Fifth Symphony especially, you hear there's a certain sense of drama and anxiety, and in some cases even tragedy. In the scherzo movement of the Fifth Symphony, he utilizes something that he never did in any of his other symphonies. He writes a very big part for what he calls a horn obbligato, which is not really a soloist, but it's intended to be, I guess, the closest thing you can have to having a solo part, but without being up front. So the way we're doing it at the performance is I'm going to have Leslie Norton, her first horn, during that movement, stand up from her chair in the back. So she will have, I guess, the presence, but without being up front, kind of taking away the thunder, stealing the thunder from the rest of the orchestra. And Mahler never wrote something like that again. The fact that that movement in particular, with this very important horn obbligato, which I guess is obligated horn, is quite interesting, that this instrument was going to kind of lead the way and the orchestra would just follow along. And that by itself, that third movement, is actually the second part of the symphony. I always say that with Gustav Mahler, his favorite word was nicht, don't. As in, don't rush, don't slow down, don't crescendo, don't get softer. I mean, it's almost like he's controlling you from beyond the grave. But when you follow his instructions to the word, you can absolutely see what he was trying to achieve musically. And it's almost like you can hear him himself conducting the music and yelling to the orchestra all these instructions that you had to follow to the letter. I've actually made the case that conducting Mahler from a technical quote-unquote point of view is actually the easiest, because when you conduct Mozart, he says allegro and good luck. When he says Beethoven, he says, presto. Okay, what does that mean? With Mahler, you get these long paragraphs, these long instructions, exactly, please take it slow, but not too slow that you have to go into four, stay in two, and make sure that you give enough room for everybody to breathe. That tells you exactly what it is that he wants. And then you get at moments that you want to, like, maybe feel like you want to slow down, and he puts these big, nicht schleppen, don't drag. Don't you dare slow down here. Keep it in tempo. Or there might be another moment that naturally you want to, like, maybe move things up. No. Stay in tempo. And at times he would put these exclamation points everywhere. Like I said, it's almost like he's yelling in your ear and say, don't do this. Make sure that you keep it. Because if you do it, you completely change the character of the piece. And I don't want you to do that. Anytime you play a Mahler symphony, it's always an event. Not only because it's such great drama from beginning to end. This was a composer that truly was able to capture the imagination of the audience. Mahler can claim that all of his works, all 14 of them, depending on how you count, are in the repertoire and are performed regularly. And I think that is a testament to his relevance in an audience that doesn't matter what time of history we're in, there is a love and appreciation to it. A big part of it also is the fact that Mahler was not afraid to utilize the largest forces imaginable. So when you attend a Mahler performance, it is something quite amazing to watch a very, very large orchestra with lots of winds and percussion and brass and unusual instruments. In the case of the Fifth Symphony, one of the more unusual instruments is what he calls a Holzklapper, which is a kind of a whip that you play two sticks of wood together, but you play them rhythmically. That's quite unusual. And to be able to see that in a performance, of course, it adds to the experience than just having to hear it, in a recording.
Congratulations on, I think it's your 6th Grammy this year. With those recordings, the Nashville Symphony's come to be known as a new music advocate. Is that responsibility something that you did consciously or subconsciously as the repertoire selections took shape?
I think it's a little bit of both. I love Rachmaninoff and Mahler and Beethoven and Brahms, and we do enough of that, but throughout the season, I mean, you have to also combine that with some of the newer voices that are being, composed as we speak. And this is nothing new. I mean, remember, Mahler was new. I mean, Beethoven was new. Mozart was new. Everybody had world premieres. So it's something that we have to keep, as artists, we have to continue expanding the repertoire. I think over the years, now about to come on my 10th season with the orchestra, we've come to find great success with American new music, which I think is quite relevant in Nashville because this is Music City, but Nashville is really American Music City when you think about it. I mean, every genre of American type music, bluegrass, rock and roll, jazz, gospel, country, whatever you want to call it, is being performed, premiered, commissioned, published right here in town. So we just happen to be doing it in our field, which is classical music. So I think in a larger sense, there has been a great acceptance here because they see it compared to what else is happening in town. Obviously, this has brought us great recognitions from our recordings. And because of that, I think it's given us a personality. And as I said, this is an orchestra that can play Richard Strauss and Beethoven and Mozart like nobody. But at the same time, you put any American composer in front of them, and this is a language that they, and they can speak very well and they can play it virtuosically. And that has given us kind of a recognition from around the world that we're doing something that needs to be done. And what great satisfaction I get personally from getting all these awards by keeping our commitment to, I think, what is new music and particularly American music. And because of it, we've established great relationship with the most important American living composers currently. And we have many, many great projects in the future with them.
It's time for a short break. When we return, more on how the maestro has to pair the practical sides of his job with the marvelous act of music making. You're listening to the Nashville Symphony performing Jennifer Higdon's Cathedrals from her Grammy-winning album, All Things Majestic.
When you want to listen to classical music but aren't near a radio, 91 Classical is still your source for great performances from Middle Tennessee and around the world. Stream music on our website while you work. Tune in via the Nashville Public Radio app on your smartphone, or tell your smart speaker you'd like to hear 91 Classical.
I'm Colleen Phelps, and welcome back to Keeping Score. Maestro Giancarlo Guerrero gave us a glimpse of what a day in the glamorous life of a conductor looks like.
Well, I actually got here at 5:30 this morning, but I am a morning person. I'm a very unusual musician in that regard because most of my colleagues are night people. But for me, I function better in the morning. I got here and the usual email answering, and I always say that conducting is by far the easiest part of my job. I mean, the administrative responsibilities of a music director with planning and, you know, and outreach and all these things that we have to do is really what eats up a lot of my time. So I do have a lot of administrative stuff that I can do, that I need to do. And in the morning, it's actually pretty good. And sometime in the middle, I manage to get at least an hour of studying where I sit with my scores and make some markings, especially because I'm rehearsing the Mahler at 10 a.m. this morning. And I actually haven't looked at the score in about 2 weeks on purpose because I finished doing my studying and just kind of let it rest. I have other music that I have to learn. But then this morning I kind of opened it, and I always find it amazing that all of a sudden all things start jumping at me, especially thinking that I will actually have to get in front of the orchestra in about an hour, you know, and start conducting it. But it's always fascinating because Mahler is a composer that I have a great affinity for and that the orchestra plays incredibly well. But there's always a little bit of apprehension because it is a massive, massive work. And you have to be very careful in your rehearsal process not to, you know, blow anything out of proportion. We have 3 concerts this week. It's a very heavy week, making sure that everybody has not only the stamina physically, but more importantly, mentally, to survive it. I cannot just deliver everything in the rehearsals. We got to save some of it for the performances. But with Mahler or with Shostakovich, it's sometimes very hard to hold back. And so sometimes during the day, I start kind of going, having a game plan and how I'm going to do the rehearsals. Maybe I'll do the first couple of movements in the morning, save the rest for the afternoon. But of course, all of these plans can all, you know, completely dissipate once the reality starts happening and new minefields start coming up. But for me, during the day, it's just, you know, administration, studying, spending time with family, of course. Just that small section is where I actually get to stand in front of the orchestra, which of course is my favorite part. There's a lot of psychology that goes into being a conductor. You almost have to be, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a priest, a brother, a sister, a grandmother, and you have to be able to pool all of these great musical resources and put them together to bring, you know, coherent performances. And sometimes with very temperamental, fantastic artists, that can be a challenge because everybody, how can you not? I mean, you bring your own opinions and your own history and your own baggage, you know, to pieces. I always say that sometimes playing the most famous piece, like a Beethoven 5 or even a Mahler 5, can be the toughest because everybody knows them and they will bring their own, you know, history to it. So your job as a conductor sometimes is to get everybody together and hopefully, you know, under one banner, present a coherent performance of that one piece. The Fifth Symphony came about this year really because Jeff Bailey, my first trumpet, requested it. I try to do at least a Mahler symphony every year, and because we had gone through all of them, I hadn't really thought about which symphony to bring back. I knew I was going to have to bring one of them. And again, I ran into Jeff in the hallway, and we were talking about something else, and he literally said, when are we doing the Fifth again? And for a trumpet player, of course, this is kind of like the Holy Grail. And immediately I said, you know what, why not next season? I did it early enough in my tenure that I think it's time to bring it back. It's one of his most popular and most beloved. And for me, it was a great chance also to showcase him. And I know Leslie Norton, my first horn, would love to get a chance to play it. So why not? It's a great piece. So that's really where it came from. As I said, I love the fact that I have such great communication with all of my players, that they themselves are a driving force behind the planning and what we want to do. And I think that is so important for morale within an ensemble, that they feel that their voices are also being heard. And we have been waiting for this for 2 years. So the fact that today is the first rehearsal has kind of been building up in emotionally. And I know that we're all very much looking forward, not only to the first rehearsal, but to the performances.
How unique do you think that is among orchestras, that communication between the principals and the conductor, and that sort of back and forth and collaborative decision-making about repertoire?
It really depends on the conductor, I think, in many cases. You have some of the older generation conductors who are very old school, where there's a certain distance, you know, between the musicians and themselves, and there's some level of mysticism and mystery. In the case of Gustav Mahler, there was a lot he wanted to say. And at times it can be difficult because there's a lot. And you want to make sure that he doesn't get lost in the cacophony, which sometimes it is that. He really pushed the envelope in terms of emotions and volumes. But it is a very human work. And I do believe that you have to combine both, you know, the heart, the mind, the brain, and all together, you provide not musical experiences, but human experiences.
Keeping Score is a production of Nashville Public Radio and 91 Classical. The show is edited by Nina Cardona and Anita Bug, with production help from Ed Lambert. In this episode, we heard performances of the Nashville Symphony engineered by Trevor Wilkinson, including Mahler's Fifth, as well as the symphony's recording of Jennifer Higdon's Cathedrals from her Grammy-winning album, All Things Majestic. Be sure to set up your automatic download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk to violinist Junie Wysocki about the many roles of the concertmaster. I'm Colleen Phelps. Thanks for listening to Keeping Score. Thank you.